This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. A recent article by the Pew Charitable Trust opens like this. Being black is bad for your health, and pervasive racism is the cause. The article cites multiple public health studies that were done over the last 30 years as evidence to back up their statements. The killing of George Floyd in Minnesota in May and the coronavirus pandemic have brought this racial inequity issue to the conscience of the nation. Towns, cities, and states are declaring racism to be a public health emergency. These events have also given energy to movements in our region to advocate more forcefully for change. Joining me now is Dr. Takesha Dwan Everett, the Executive Director of Health Equity Solutions. It focuses on achieving health equity in Connecticut. Dr. Everett, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What does it mean to identify racism as a public health crisis? Why should we do that?
Thanks for that question. It's important to recognize the issue pervasively that racism has in our society and its impact on health. When we declare it a public health crisis, it allows us to do what we usually do with any public health issue or emergency or crisis, and that's focus our resources and efforts towards the root cause of the issue and eradicating it and changing its impact on the health of the public. That's the mere point of public health and why it needs to happen. I think the recent results, not only of what we've seen around the trauma related to the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, beyond that, I think we're also seeing the physical impact of what's happening in COVID-19. So I think all of these things combined together really help us to understand the crisis we're facing right now.
Now, your organization advocates for equal health care access, delivery, and outcomes in Connecticut. Why are these things out of reach for some people?
It's our belief that the long historical and contemporary results of structural and institutional racism are the reasons we see the inequities in health that exist in Connecticut. Connecticut is one of the most segregated states in the nation. We rank somewhere in the top five states around racial segregation. We have deep wealth and income inequality in our state. And all of this is rooted, again, in the historical and contemporary context of structural racism. I wanted to say what I mean by that, to be very clear, is this isn't a conversation about interpersonal racism, whether you or I or any other individuals like or dislike each other based on the perceived notion of our skin color. It's really deeper than that. It's about the insidious nature, the covert understanding, and the things that are happening around our policies that reinforce institutional and structural racism.
Now, of course, as you know, the town of Windsor in Connecticut and a couple of other towns as well, several others, have adopted the resolution that declares racism to be a public health crisis. So making a declaration, that's one thing. But in terms of action, what action do you think Connecticut can take to make sure that the issue of systemic racism is honestly addressed?
Yes, to date, we're up to 17 cities and towns across Connecticut who have declared racism a public health crisis through a declaration or resolution. And I'd like to add the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation has done so as well.
Oh.
With several of the cities and towns, what they've done is gone beyond just a declaration, which the declaration or resolution that they have passed has some deep action steps rooted in it. But some of the cities and towns, including Windsor, have gone further and have already begun to take those next steps, instituting a task force of citizens and policymakers working together to analyze locally what policies they may have in place that is impeding their ability to have health equity and move forward with racial equity in their local town. Some other options that are available to policymakers and citizens are to really think about the allocation of resources in a different way. Are we serving our citizens in the best manner if we're not looking at those who are falling through the cracks and not actually able to attain their best health or live a successful life in our cities and towns? These are just a few steps, and there are a lot of organizations that we can point cities and towns to help them guide their process.
Is there something then on the state level that can help this process? It's one thing for many municipalities to be involved in one way or another, but is there something farther up the food chain, so to speak, in Hartford that can help this along?
Sure. I would say I could give you about three examples. I should never enumerate because sometimes I do three or sometimes I do less. But a few quick examples of what could be done. I think a statewide declaration acknowledging the impact of racism in our state as a public health crisis could very well help, and that could come from the governor or the state legislature when they reconvene. Paired with that, I think we could start taking an approach of understanding what would it mean to budget differently in our state if we were trying to promote and advance racial equity in our state. And what I mean by that is, it's not a conversation about defining or looking for new resources. It's really the question of, are we best allocating the resources we currently have to help the folks who are the most disadvantaged by our system? And then I would lastly add that having a equity focus within our policymaking, which could include making a statewide task force that's at the gubernatorial level and the agency level to evaluate all of our policy and action steps through a lens of equity could be helpful. That also could mean doing that at the legislative level. There was a bill passed 2 years ago, I believe, that allows for racial and ethnic impact statements on any law upon request by any policymaker. But we haven't funded that to sustainably allow that to happen. That could help as well.
I understand you've reached out to Governor Ned Lamont and the Acting Commissioner of Public Health, Deidre Gifford, about this. Have they followed up with you? Have you heard back from them?
We've heard the governor and publicly state that he's really unclear about what it means and what the connection would be around declaring racism a public health crisis. And we continue to provide information of the other states who've done so to date. Minnesota, Wisconsin have both done this, and I think there are two other states that are, I can't remember right at the moment, but there are at least four states that have moved forward with this, and we continue to share that information in the hopes that not just because we're asking, but also based on the town action and the cry from the over 1,000 individuals who signed our petition about intentional racist, anti-racist policymaking, that he can come to discover what Connecticut can do and really engage to move us forward.
If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Dr. Takesha Dwan Everett, the Executive Director of Health Equity Solutions, an organization focusing on achieving health equity in Connecticut. This week, Connecticut's representative for the 5th District, 5th Congressional District, Johanna Hayes, released a statement that she titled, "I Am Not Okay." This was in response to racial slurs injected into one of her Zoom town halls by Internet trolls. And in it, she describes how racism wears at a person's emotional and mental well-being. Do you think this is a conversation starter that could help honestly address the impact that systemic racism has on the health of our communities?
Well, Tom, I just want to say that I think what happened to Representative Hayes was deplorable. And if it is the action that will launch everyone into understanding the detrimental, traumatic events that happen on a regular basis through covert and overt racism and microaggressions that Black people and Black women like myself face on a regular basis, if this is the action that moves us forward, then hopefully we can advance to greater racial equity in our state. But I also want to highlight, it shouldn't just take this blatant offensive action to move us forward. What happened to Representative Hayes combined with COVID-19, what has happened with the deaths of the murders, I should say, of Black and brown people at the hands of our police, we should be ready to really acknowledge the weathering effect, the tireless effect that racism is having on people of color. It's just time that we really acknowledge this. And I'm hopeful that people listen to Representative Hayes' cry and really start to understand how systemic racism is a problem, interpersonal racism is a problem, and that we all have a responsibility and an ability to change this. My heart goes out to her and to everyone who experienced that with her.
And understanding that this problem of systemic racism in so many areas is literally hundreds of years old. Do you think this point in time, this very unusual year of 2020 for all the reasons you've just mentioned and others, it could be the turning point that moves us down that path further and faster?
I think so. I mean, if not now, when? And we've heard this before, but I can only state, if not now, when? When are we going to address this? I think it's time for us in this unusual pandemic to realize it. We should not have another generation born into this awful system of racism. The notion of race is a social construct, which means it is man-created and man-made. Racism is a system that is man-delivered and man-reinforced, and I should say human instead of man to ungender that, which means we have the power to make the change in this. This is something we can do. We just have to all wake up and realize the status quo is hurting all of us. This is not just an issue that's hurting people of color. It's also hurting white people. We're not able to advance collectively in this nation and in our great state of Connecticut with the system of racism continuing as it is. The time is now.
Dr. Everett, thanks so much for your time today and for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate your story.
Dr. Takesha Dwan Everett is the Executive Director of Health Equity Solutions in Connecticut. Some Connecticut state lawmakers are also advocating for the General Assembly to adopt the resolution. We've asked State Senator Matthew Lesser to tell us more about this. He's a Democrat from Middletown, and he co-chairs the legislature's Insurance Committee. Senator Lesser, hello, and thanks for joining us.
Well, it's great to be on with you.
How did this issue, racism as a healthcare issue, come to the table for discussion?
Well, we started hearing, it's been clear for a long time that Connecticut is a state of contrast. You look at different parts of the state, and either we are the wealthiest state of the country, or we have a lot of people who are falling behind. And in many ways, that falls along racial lines. And so we were aware of the problem of health disparities before the pandemic. But my goodness, has that really just risen to the top as we see the greatest health challenge any of us have had to deal with in a century. So the pandemic has really underscored, the critical threat that health disparities play to the state. And then beyond that, what we're seeing is organizing, a clamoring for action by communities across the state who are calling on the state to take action. We're hearing the voices of the communities of color and also folks who are looking to really make change in the wake of the actions we saw this summer, the people coming together all across in communities across the state, saying that Black Lives Matter, asking for real action to make the state a better place. And so one thing we absolutely need to do is tackle health equity. And I think the first place to start is by just admitting the reality, which is that racism is a public health crisis in the state and something we can and should acknowledge and then take steps to address.
And have you seen some of that acknowledgement in the General Assembly? Did it come up, for instance, during the special session held this summer?
Well, we haven't addressed it so far. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. a huge believer that we should address health equity in a huge and big way. Certainly, some of the legislation that we passed this summer, capping the cost of insulin, and on expanding the access to telehealth, particularly for folks on Medicaid, will make a small difference. But we have to address this issue head on, and I'm hopeful that we will make that a top priority as we head into 2021.
As a co-chair of the Insurance Committee, have you seen evidence, or what evidence have you seen? I should probably pose the question that way. What evidence have you seen of this racial health gap? Again, through your work on the Insurance Committee.
Oh, it's everywhere you look, right? It's on life expectancy. It's on who has health insurance and who doesn't. It's impacted in the emergence of high deductible health plans, which may be a good product if you have the money to pay for your deductible, but if you don't, you don't. But you see on every health metric, you see different outcomes based on race and ethnicity in Connecticut, and the differences are stark, and that's a real problem. And if you didn't get that before we were dealing with a viral pandemic. My guide, you should now, because if your neighbor gets sick with COVID and they don't have insurance or they're not getting the quality of care from their provider that they should be getting, that's going to affect you. And so it's in all of our interests to make sure that we're tackling this issue and we're putting it first.
Do you think there's something through the insurance committee, on the General Assembly Insurance Committee, do you think there's something the committee can do to address the health effects of systemic racism on Connecticut residents?
I think there's a ton of things we can do. So we have a long list of wish list items. I think the first thing to do is just simply acknowledge make a public statement that this is a priority. But beyond that, we are facing in the middle of a pandemic a crisis of uninsurance, right? Because people are losing their employer sponsored healthcare when they lose their jobs. And that is the worst thing that could happen to somebody in the middle of a pandemic. People need more healthcare right now, not less. And so really what Connecticut should be doing is following the lead of other states and charting our own course, doing more to make sure that every person in this state, whether you're white, black, Asian, Hispanic, what have you, has access to health insurance that you can access, that you can use, it's affordable. And we have a lot of work to do. So I think we can do that. I think the governor shares that vision, and I'm hopeful that this will be a huge priority in 2021.
As I'm sure you know, the town of Windsor back in June became the first municipality in the state to recognize officially by vote of the town council racism as a public health crisis. I'm wondering, have you heard anything, possibly spoken with Governor Lamont about the state adopting a resolution like that, which declares racism a public health crisis?
Well, the governor can make proclamations on his own. What I'd like to do is have the General Assembly make a declaration along those lines. And I will say one of the communities I represent, Middletown, has also put its name behind that. So I absolutely think that that's something we should do. I think that's necessary, but I don't think it's sufficient. I think we have to go beyond that to also address some of the root causes of health disparities, and that's everything from cultural competency to making sure that immigrants who are currently barred from even to purchase health insurance, have access to it. We need to take steps all along the way to make sure that equity is a priority of our state's public health policymaking.
Are you hearing anything from your constituents on this issue?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. No, the differences are stark. And people mention it to me when I'm at doors, when I'm talking to folks. Right now, I think you've never heard a louder call for action on healthcare. This is a public health crisis, and people want the state to do more to keep people healthy and safe. And, I think by and large, they feel like we are doing a good job of that, but there is a lot more that needs to be done. And the biggest issue is this equity question. We've got great health care for some people in Connecticut, but not for everybody right now.
Given your enthusiasm for pursuing this, it sounds like it's an issue that could come up with more specific proposals, bills in the next session of the legislature?
Absolutely. This will be a huge priority of mine, and I'm sure for many members of the caucus. And I'll also say that some of my Republican colleagues also seem to be prioritizing the issue as well. And I'm hopeful we can build a bipartisan consensus on making this, agenda number one going into the next legislative session.
Senator Lesser, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
I really appreciate it.
State Senator Matthew Lesser is a Democrat representing Middletown. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. We've explored how Connecticut has taken on facing racism as a public health crisis. But what's New York doing to address the issue? This past June, the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene announced in a tweet that it was, and quoting here, committed to addressing structural racism within our own institution and addressing racism as a social detriment of health as part of our mission to protect the health of New Yorkers. How does a pledge like this translate into actual policy? Helping to answer that question is Elizabeth Ryden Benjamin. She's the vice president of New York-based health initiatives at the Community Service Society, where she supervises health policy, health advocacy, and consumer health assistance programs. Ms. Benjamin, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
I'd like to ask you first, which communities in New York would you say have their health compromised the most because of race?
Wow. I mean, I think it feels, you know, and the data would support that nearly every community is experiencing racial disparities in health outcomes. And I think nothing has made that more starkly apparent than in the COVID pandemic. Many people have observed that the death rate for people of color in New York City was twice that of white folks. But in the rest of the state, the disparity is four times for people of color than white folks. So I think the answer to your question is there are disparities in health outcomes, and the COVID pandemic has had a disparate impact on people of color, regardless of where you live in this state.
What's the biggest challenge then for people of color, for people in black and brown communities when it comes to maintaining their health?
It's so systemic. And I'm sort of concerned about the framing of that question, because I think the challenge isn't a problem for people of color. I think the challenge is for all of us. All of us should want people to have equal outcomes in when experiencing the COVID pandemic. And I think what has happened is that people of color are more likely to be essential workers. People of color are more likely to live in tighter housing situations, multi-generational housing, more likely to be homeless, more likely to be incarcerated, more likely to be in nursing homes that are potentially susceptible to the pandemic. And so I think we need to, as a society, work to make essential workers safer, provide, you know, essential workers masks and good masks, N95 masks, not just cloth masks. I think we need to sort of think through how we, you know, there's huge delays in improving the housing stock for public housing and incredible, you know, fiscal woes there. We need to invest in low-income people of color housing. We need to invest in health resources in communities of color, which have been, you know, systematically divested from over the past 30 years.
As you suggest, reframing that question, it brings me back to that statement made by the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene about committing to addressing structural racism in their own institution and addressing it as part of a mission to protect the health of New Yorkers. Does that really have the potential for a positive health impact for the communities living with systemic racism? I mean, a pledge is one thing, but turning it into policy and real change for people dealing with racism is another, isn't it?
True. I think that is right. And I think, of course, a lot of health policy making actually is conducted out of Albany. Local communities rarely have, you know, so-called home rule in mediating health policy or making health resource decisions. So, for example, if a hospital is open or closed, that decision is approved by a panel, you know, out of Albany. And that panel is made up of hospital insiders mostly. So I think if we're really serious about addressing health disparities, and we wrote a paper about this, we really need to look deeply at state health policy decision making. That's really been, you know, the source of this really started, I'm sure, you know, hundreds of years ago, but we don't have to look that far back. We can look at the 90s when our state decided to deregulate a lot of our health care resources. So we used to have hospital rates set by the state, and that meant that rich hospitals were paid essentially the same rate as poorer hospitals. So safety net hospitals were supported and able to access reasonable reimbursement rates. Well, that got deregulated, and it's been every, you know, hospital for itself, and the rich have gotten richer and the poor hospitals have closed. In Queens, for example, we're missing four hospitals that have closed as a result of some of this deregulatory activity. And those four hospitals are right in that corridor where communities of color live, between Elmhurst and essentially the Rockaways. That is a problem. We have to really think about how we as a state can invest and divert resources to safety net institutions that are, you know, working and serving communities of color. And that's a serious, you know, resource allocation question. And that means hard decisions have to be made, but we can't continue with this situation where we have 6.5 beds for everybody in Manhattan and 1.5 beds for everybody in Queens. You know, we're missing 25,000 hospital beds, and those hospital beds, you know, I can assure you are in communities of color, not in well-heeled white neighborhoods.
I'd like to take a bit of a turn here and ask you about access to mental health care when it comes to communities that are affected by systemic racism. What kinds of problems exist in that area?
Well, that is another really difficult topic. I think a lot of people justify the deregulation of, you know, hospital rates and the closing of hospitals saying, oh, well, this will be replaced by more primary care capacity and mental health capacity. And to some extent, we've seen some of that, but not enough. You know, New York, our healthcare system is very dominated by tertiary facilities, the hospital industry. Mm. And we really need to think deeply and act accordingly on how we can build up more primary care capacity and more mental health capacity. It's very difficult, for example, for young people. Pediatric mental health services are very under-resourced, and we don't have enough of them. Adolescent mental health resources, again, under-resourced. And then there's also sort of a problem where we've really invested in health insurance plans and managed care to establish capacity. And we know that there are serious parity problems where the structure of how health insurance is created doesn't reimburse providers from the provider's perspective well enough for them to be participating in health insurance networks. And so we see many patients through our program complain that they try to find a mental health provider through their insurance network, but they don't take health insurance, or they're aware of a mental health provider, but their provider won't take health insurance. And so I think we really need to think about how to invest more in mental health services and how to encourage and structure our health insurance products so that they are actually facilitating access to mental health services in a really robust manner. Because, you know, these are difficult times and people need the support.
Ms. Benjamin, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to participate. And good luck for everybody and as we experience the next couple of months.
Same to you. Thank you. Elizabeth Ryden Benjamin is the Vice President of New York-based Health Initiatives at the Community Service Society. 39 health systems around the country have already declared racism a public health crisis. Northwell Health, based in New Hyde Park, New York, is one of them. Uday Tambar is Vice President of Community Health at Northwell Health, and he was key in Northwell's recent signing of the statement issued by the Healthcare Anchor Network. That's a consortium of health systems across the country that are committed to harnessing their economic power to benefit the well-being of their communities. Mr. Tambar, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you very much for having me.
Could you tell me, when did Northwell Health sign on to this statement?
Sure. You know, it went public earlier this month or the end of September. And, you know, in advance of that, we've been working with about close to 40 other systems to sign on to this very important statement.
Could you tell me, too, why was it important for your organization to take part in this, to take on racism as a public health crisis?
Absolutely. You know, I think we have known for a long time that to improve the health of, you know, patients and their communities, what we do with them directly in terms of patient care is a piece of the puzzle, but not the entire puzzle. A lot of the research has shown that 20% of health outcomes are based on access and quality of your clinical care. The other 80% are socioeconomic factors, including structural barriers like racism. What happened, and we've known this for a long time, and what's happened recently is two major things have intersected. One is obviously COVID, and second is the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, COVID has shown us that it's not the great equalizer. There were clear disparities by wealth and race. Poor and communities of color were impacted more. you know, there was research that we at Northwell had done that showed that underlying health issues made one more at risk of getting COVID. It showed that health equity is not a sideshow. It's the main event, that in these times of crisis, that those living on the margins, communities of color, low-income communities, are the ones most likely to be harmed. And Black Lives Matter, you know, we saw that structural racism doesn't exist just in the criminal justice system. We've seen that this exists throughout, you know, our society. What I'm saying is that all of this has sort of raised this issue to the surface. And as healthcare systems, you know, we are sort of the anchor institutions. You know, we have such a large footprint in communities, and how we hire, how we purchase, how we invest can transform the economics of communities. So it's very important for us in this time with COVID and Black Lives Matter to really take sort of a public leadership role in saying that, you know, racism is a public health crisis.
So Northwell, you had hard data. Northwell Health had hard data collected that revealed the role racism plays in the healthcare systems.
Yeah, and so, you know, in response to that, like, we know that with around, let's say, maternal mortality, we launched a new initiative to address this, to focusing, reducing extra risks that are borne by Black moms in childbirth. The data shows, and this is a national number, that they're four times more likely to have a bad outcome in pregnancy compared to other races. And so these disparities exist in other, you know, sort of diseases as well. And so we've been trying to address it. And I think the big shift in thinking is when we talk about, you know, racism as a public health crisis. You know, before we used to just say that, look, race is associated with a particular outcome. But now I think we're saying that racism is associated with the outcomes. In other words, since there's no genetic link between race and outcomes, but rather the effect of racism on health outcomes, it really names the problem, which is racism, and forces us to tease apart what we mean. So it's sort of a lot, you know, stopping us, and my colleague, Dr. Nigan Hajizadeh uses terms, you know, stops us from hiding under this blanket of terms and really forces us to be specific.
So then how does acknowledging that racism affects people's health change, for example, how Northwell provides health services to communities directly affected by racism?
Absolutely. So, you know, one area we've been partnering with the state has been around the COVID testing. It was clear that in black and brown communities that, you know, which were impacted more by COVID than in other communities, that there was a lack of testing that was going on. So Northwell, partnering with the state, has done more than 62,000 state diagnostic antibody and community sites across the state. And this is, you know, we're the largest healthcare system in New York State, the largest employer in New York State. So we partnered with faith-based organizations, churches, and communities of color. With the town of Hempstead, you know, where a lot of vulnerable communities there, we've been partnering with them to provide free antibody testing to the to residents, recognizing that these are vulnerable communities that have been particularly hard. Been taking this sort of proactive approach with COVID to sort of address the unmet need in these communities.
Mr. Tambar, thank you so much for being on The Full Story today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Uday Tambar is Vice President of Community Health at Northwell Health. The pandemic has highlighted the inequity in healthcare in our country based on race. We've asked Elaine Gross, the founder and president of Erase Racism, to help us understand this more clearly. Erase Racism is a regional civil rights organization based on Long Island that exposes and addresses the impact of historical and ongoing structural racism, particularly in housing and public school education. Ms. Gross, welcome to The Full Story.
You're very welcome. Glad to be with you.
There's an infographic on your website, the Erase Racism website, which illustrates how structural racism resulted in Black communities on Long Island being impacted disproportionately by COVID-19. And it shows that on Long Island, for every one white person who dies of the coronavirus, three Black people die, even though Black people make up less than 11% of the population. Why is COVID-19 having such a devastating impact on Black residents of Long Island?
Well, there are several factors. One has to do with the underlying health conditions that are more common among Black people. you know, from the very beginning, the CDC said that if you had certain kinds of conditions, when you got the virus, it was more likely you would have complications and that they would be more likely to send you to the hospital as a result of that, and then you would be more likely to die from those complications. So certainly that's one of the factors. The other factor has to do with who has been able to really do social distancing, including not to have to be in crowded work conditions, et cetera. People who have been able to stay home, work from home,
mm-hmm.
It is much more likely, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, that for black workers and for Hispanic workers as well, they're going to be more likely to be employed in the service industry jobs. And those were the kind of jobs where you were going to work during the COVID-19. You were in one of those essential businesses. And so if you combine having higher exposure in the first place and the underlying conditions, well, they call it a perfect storm, those kinds of things.
If we could talk a bit more about the underlying conditions, that would suggest that the disparity that was highlighted by COVID-19 is not necessarily just peculiar to COVID-19. In other words, conditions existed prior to the pandemic that led people living in these communities to be susceptible to these underlying conditions. In other words, other health problems that they have not been able to address adequately.
Yes. Well, there are structural impediments to access to health care. That's like being able to get to a doctor, to afford to be able to go to a doctor. There's also environmental concerns, whether you are in communities where there might be more likelihood of having asthma, for example, the kinds of conditions, including air quality and other factors in the housing where you live that might make you more likely to have asthma, which, of course, being able to breathe is one of the problems with COVID. So it exacerbates that problem. There's a long history of what we call structural racism.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been typically instigated and sanctioned by government. And Long Island is a model, if you will, of structural racism because we were developed to be racially segregated. The government had policies when a place like Levittown was built, late 40s, early 50s. You're talking 17,000 homes, and the black veterans were not allowed to purchase. And there were racial covenants in the deeds, which basically said you cannot resell to someone who is not white or Caucasian. So the structural racism is really when you have those kinds of laws and policies and practices which capture not just one person or two people, but the whole population. And that has really been the thing that has affected the health of Long Islanders and a lot of other things as well.
What needs to be taken care of first, then, in order to deal with this crisis in public health care, racism as a public health care crisis?
Well, there's a lot that has been known for some time by the health professionals. It's not like this is a new problem.
Mm.
And they also know, there's been research that's shown that that doctors can sometimes have different diagnoses and different treatment based on race. And not because there should be a difference, but that there is something called implicit bias, which complicates this whole thing.
Mm.
But it has been shown that once the doctors are made aware of this, that they weren't giving the same kind of pain treatments for blacks. They were performing larger numbers of amputations on blacks. Doctors have been able to course correct, to change their behavior once they're made aware of this kind of thing. So it's a combination of the professional development, but also being very serious about the social determinants of health. In other words, the people that care about the health status need to also care about the quality of the housing, the quality of the air, water. There needs to be a way for some of these chronic diseases to try to keep people from getting the chronic diseases, and then once they get it, to make sure that they can get the kind of treatment that they need. Diabetes is one of those things. Once you get it, that's ongoing treatment that they need, ongoing medication. And that really speaks to the Affordable Care Act, quite frankly. You know, we were able to get a lot more people covered through the Affordable Care Act. It hasn't captured everybody, and so we definitely need an expansion of that and a deepening of the coverage so that no one has to make a choice between, am I going to feed my family or am I going to go out and get my metformin, you know, or whatever it is, or my insulin or whatever I need. What we're talking about here is all of those things that are contributing to the health disparities in the first place.
As you pointed out, some of the structural racism is certainly not new. It goes back hundreds of years in some cases. COVID-19, the pandemic, seems to have bubbled up much of the discussion of this to the surface, at least on talk shows like this. I'm wondering, do you think this will make it more clear to the society at large that these problems are very deep-seated and need to be addressed the way you just described in housing and in many other areas of society?
I certainly hope it will. And there are some signs that there is a growing understanding that there is unfinished business related to structural racism. You know, I don't expect overnight changes to everything, but I do expect that we'll see a whittling away, a chipping away at some of those impediments, and we'll have greater recognition among a wider group of individuals that, guess what, folks, we have something that is not going to go away by itself, and there needs to be a certain amount of trust. People need to feel that you have their best interest, and that will help them be more forthcoming, be more ready to take advice and to try something new. And then we need the people who are the caregivers to understand their own biases and to, you know, to check themselves, to say, okay, wait a minute. Why did I make the assumption that that person that I'm seeing right now only has a drug problem? Why might not it be that there is an underlying mental health condition that's going on? Mm. And they've been doing some self-medication, so to speak, with the drugs. So there's a lot. There is a lot. It's complicated, and it requires being open to different kinds of analysis of what the problem is and how to address it.
Ms. Gross, thanks so much for your insights today. We'd like to check in with you in the not-too-distant future to see if this is indeed a turning point in improving things.
You are very welcome, and I'd love to speak with you again.
Elaine Gross is the founder and president of Erase Racism. That's it for our program today, produced by Fatou Sangari and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.